Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and as often is the case, right next to me is Russell Chianelli, and we're going to be talking, continuing our discussion, on the breakthroughs of 2015, as sort of stated by the magazine Science, publication of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And number one this year was what they called the Year of the Small Worlds. And in particular, they were fascinated and very happy to find out the results of the flyby past Pluto. And we've got a special guest today, Dr. Rita Beebe. She's been on the program once before, maybe 20 years ago. But Rita's at New Mexico State University in the Department of Astronomy. And Rita, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
So tell us, what was the big deal about this flyby of Pluto? What was the really big, enlightening information that we gathered?
Well, previous to this flyby, the very best spatial resolution we had had on the planet was from the Hubble Space Telescope. And what you saw in those images was just simply contrasting reflectivity across the surface. We couldn't distinguish that from just simply impact craters and that sort of thing. So although we had studied the system in enough detail to realize it was a very thin atmosphere, we were sort of locked into the idea that this was going to be sort of a simple type of planet with not too much activity. When we flew by in July, there was considerable surprise in the contrast of the surface features. You have areas which are covered with nitrogen ice, and there's a lot of dynamic activity there. And you also have mountain ranges that are as high as the Rocky Mountains. So that you find out that, as far as the geologists are concerned, they have a whole bevy of processes now that they can study in a different environment than they've ever seen it before.
So let's just ask the question then. You say that there's this sort of sea of nitrogen and that there are rocky mountains there also. What's the technique for making sure we understand that it's just liquid nitrogen or solid nitrogen? And the rocks, we assume, are then some inorganic material like rocks are anywhere in our world.
Well, we assume basically that this planet formed by a mixture of materials. When we look at the activity on the surface, it appears that there has been plenty of action on this small body so that the things should be differentiated. And it's generally felt now that a lot of the heavy solids went to the center and formed a core. That's probably surrounded by a water ice envelope. And then outside of that, we have the surface structures and its nitrogen ices. When you're as far away from the sun as Pluto is, depending on whether you're close in its irregular orbit, if you're closest to the sun or farthest from the sun, you'll have a temperature range of about, it's minus 360 degrees to minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit. So this seems like it's pretty cold.
Just to remind the audience, what is a plutonic year in our years?
248 years.
So when we were looking at it, was it close to the sun or far away?
Okay, we were closest to the sun in 1987, I think. And now we're moving away from it.
Yeah, but not very far, given the fact that it's got a period of 200-odd years. That's a big year.
That's right. This planet rotates once every about 6.4 days on its axis, and it's locked with one face always pointing toward its largest moon. And if you could pick up the Earth, you could just simply fit it between Pluto and its moon, Charon. So it's really a small, compact system, and they are tidally locked. Their faces always point to each other. So we see actual different structures on the outward side of Pluto and the side that faces its moon.
Interesting. So you mentioned the word water. And you also mentioned ice. Should I and the audience imply that there's liquid water involved on Pluto? That seems very odd.
Well, it depends on how much radioactive material was in the original heavy materials that we think fell to the center. It could still be in a cooling process. So deep inside, it could be considerably warmer than it is on the outside.
But that's conjecture at the present moment, right?
Right. And the conjecture is that it would be an envelope of water ice. Now, because of some of the structures we're seeing on the surface, it looks as though there's some activity, some flow activities. So the processes that go on may occasionally release some liquids, but it's probably liquid nitrogen, not liquid water, that would generate all of these features that we would see.
Is that what a cryovolcano is?
Yes.
So a cryovolcano is something that's spurting out these things from deeper in the core?
Well, I wouldn't put them all the way to the core. Basically, what you would have is you would have some sort of a structure where there would be either a faulting that would allow material to move upward, or there would be maybe like a greenhouse effect where you have dark material below a transparent ice and you can trap the sunshine in there and bring it up. You only have to bring the temperature up to about minus 350 degrees Fahrenheit to get the nitrogen ice to melt. So the range of temperatures that we would expect to occur over a Pluto year are so close to the melting point of the nitrogen ice that if, when we talk about these temperatures of minus 360 to minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit, we're talking about average temperatures. And it turns out that the surface of Pluto has probably the strongest contrast and reflectivity of any body in the solar system. So that there are areas where they're darker and they would be absorbing more of the sunlight. So it's quite possible that since you only have to raise it just a few degrees, you can change the nitrogen ice to liquid nitrogen and get the cryo-type structures.
And can you get clouds of nitrogen, like you can get clouds of water vapor here on Earth?
Okay, you will always have the gases in the atmosphere in balance with the surface. So when you're close to the sun, near the closest approach to the sun, you're at local temperatures where you're melting some of the nitrogen ices, and you'll get sublimation. You'll get the nitrogen molecules escaping. You'll get some methane molecules also coming out of the ices. The methane molecules are absolute wonderful absorbers of infrared. They create a terrific greenhouse. So in the atmosphere of Pluto, you can actually get a temperature inversion where the temperatures of the atmosphere are a little bit higher than those on the surface. And we're seeing layered clouds in Pluto's atmosphere that reach up to like 100 miles high in the atmosphere.
In the science article, which was rated number one, it says a big year for small worlds, and it mentions two other ones, Ceres and a third small one. Can you tell us what they are?
Okay, Ceres is the largest body in the asteroid belt. It was reclassified by the International Astronomical Union as a minor planet. I don't like that. I would like to remain an asteroid so you could compare it to the other asteroids. There is a mission named Dawn. It went first to Vesta and did a detailed study of it, and then on out to Ceres. Vesta was located close enough to the sun that it should have been made out of mostly heavy materials. And Ceres was far enough from the sun that it could be quite an icy body. It turns out that the study we've done so far on Ceres, it's a rather inactive surface. There are a lot of impact features on it. In the bottom of some of the craters, there are reflective areas that indicate that there may be some outgassing of ice. But basically, it's not nearly as exciting as Pluto.
So the real bottom line here, Rita, is the fact that Pluto all of a sudden has now revealed itself as a very dynamic area or volume or species, and not just an inert chunk of rock like most people were thinking originally. Is that the big take-home message?
That's right. Okay, and let's not forget that Pluto is the first of the Plutinos, a large family of small bodies similar to Pluto. They're in an orbit out beyond the planet Neptune. Oh. 5 years ago, we considered those to be like primitive objects. If we could get out to them, we could sample the primitive surface. Pluto has certainly shot a hole in that idea, because it's obvious that there has been a huge amount of reprocessing of that surface. This is no primitive surface. This is a highly advanced geological surface.
There was one point that you made that really intrigued me. That is, you said, because if there's radioactive material in the core, that's obviously going to be generating a certain amount of energy, and that could well, in fact, cause liquid water way down there. Is that typical of all of those planets way out there and all those planetoids, large amounts of radioactive materials?
As far as we're concerned, any time a body forms in the solar system, it's going to be made up of a normal mixture of elements. And among those elements are radioactive isotopes. And some of them have half-lives of just a few years, some of them very long years. They're all fairly massive atoms, and they would all sink to the center. So that if the body is processed enough that it differentiates and the heavies go to the center, you will have this heat source in the center. Now, in the case of Jupiter and Saturn, the amount of energy that those two bodies give off exceeds the amount that they're getting from the sun by several percentages. So even though it's been a long time and you would think the cooling would have gone on and it's all over, it's definitely not for those large bodies.
You know, it's a beautiful summary of where we are. And clearly, it's as fascinating to Russell and I now as it is to you. We were both pretty ignorant before this. But Rita Beebe, New Mexico State University Department of Astronomy, thank you very much for being here to outline the big adventure that Pluto is giving the science world these days.
Thank you, and I'm totally fascinated with its atmosphere.
Absolutely. So are we now. We're all Pluto fans. You're listening to Science Studio. My name's Keith Pannell, here with Russ Chinelli, and we've been talking to Rita Beebe from NMSU, Astronomy Department, about Pluto. We'll be back in one moment. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the second part of Science Studio. And as promised, today we're going to sort of unravel the big advances of 2015, as determined by Science Magazine, on quantum entanglement. As I said earlier, the title of their little article is Quantum Weirdness Confirmed. Well, we've got a specialist on the phone, a professor of physics from New Mexico State University, Stephen Pate. And Steve, welcome to Science Studio. And would you just please give us the historical perspective? What is this quantum entanglement business?
Thank you for having me on the program. Quantum entanglement involves a very basic intuition that most of us have about the universe, which turns out to be wrong. So I have to explain first what that intuition is. So humans have evolved in a world of very large, very heavy, very slow-moving objects. And it turns out that the behavior of those large, heavy, slow-moving objects is very predictable. And a few hundred years ago, the rules for predicting those things were put together by Isaac Newton. And we have what's called Newton's laws. And Newton's laws are very, very, very useful when applied to large, heavy, slow-moving objects. And so, for example, planets, or if you throw a ball or roll something down the hill, and there's just an enormous wide range of application. But one of the important things about Newton's laws, which Newton probably himself didn't even think about, was that the objects have an independent existence from our interaction with them. So just to give you a simple example, let's suppose I pick up a baseball and I throw it out into a field. And I close my eyes so that I don't see where the ball lands. So the ball's out there somewhere. We have that very strong feeling. And hope. If I know the direction in which I threw the ball, and if I've thrown balls before, I could probably walk out into the field and find the ball after a few minutes. we think we know where the ball is and that it's out there. And those are very strongly held feelings that we have. It turns out that when you look into the world of the atom, so these are very small, very low mass, very rapidly moving objects, that the rules are very different down there. And we started to learn about that about 120 years ago. And we learned that certain things, not everything, but certain things are not very predictable. So, for example, the motion of an electron around an atom is not entirely predictable. So we learned that we can't ask questions like, where is the electron exactly? We can ask questions like, if I looked in a certain place, what's the probability that I'll find the electron here? That's a question that I can ask. But I can't ask exactly where is the electron and expect to get reasonable answers. So that was already a little bit disturbing when people started to figure that out in sort of the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s. And many people challenged that the notion that things weren't predictable. But the new rules that people came up with, which we call quantum mechanics, as distinguished from Newton's mechanics, those rules are very, very good at predicting the outcome of the experiments. And so you have to pay attention to them. But they imply that there's this randomness, in a certain amount of randomness in the universe, and people didn't like that. So some people thought the reason for the randomness is because there's something that we don't know. There's an underlying deterministic structure that we just don't know about. And so the universe appears random to us because of our lack of knowledge. And that's an entirely reasonable explanation. Just to give you a quick example, let's talk about the digits of the number pi. We all know the first few digits, 3.14159, etc. So if I ask the question, what's the 354th digit of pi? You can calculate that. It might be 3. I don't know what it is, okay? But you can calculate what that number is. But if I gave you 20 digits of pi that were out there around 354 and ask you, what are these numbers? Where do they come from? You couldn't tell me. They would look entirely random to you. But they're not random. They're totally determined because what's behind them is the number pi. So that's an example where something could look random, but it's not. So many people thought that underneath the rules of quantum mechanics, there must be a deterministic system where everything actually is known, but we just don't know what it is yet. So Einstein, for example, said that quantum mechanics must be incomplete. That was his word, that we don't know everything yet. And if we knew about this underlying system, then everything would become predictable again, which is a very interesting notion. So you can stop me if I've gone too far. But
no, I'm actually sitting here thinking, I want you to come down and teach one of my classes.
Okay. So for a long time, many people thought this was just a sort of philosophical question because it didn't change how you predicted the outcome of an experiment. But in 1964, another scientist named John Bell discovered that there actually are experiments you can do that can distinguish whether or not this underlying deterministic system even exists, which was a revolution. And people immediately started to do experiments to try to test his ideas, to employ his ideas. But they're very difficult experiments to do. And so initially there was a lot of struggles to get them done. But certainly by the late 70s, it was already pretty clear that there was no underlying deterministic system, that there really is randomness built into the universe. And the experiments that have occurred most recently that have made a big splash are very, very technically advanced, and they've closed all sorts of loopholes, questions that you could continue to ask. So how do these experiments work? Let me say something about that very, very briefly. You can create a pair of particles that share some common property between them. For example, two pieces of light, two photons, can be created that are correlated with each other, and you can have the photons then travel away from each other for as much distance as you want. And then you can do a measurement on one of the photons in one place, and that instantly implies what the result of a similar measurement will be on the other photon, which might be hundreds of kilometers away. And those are the experiments that people have done, or experiments like those, where two objects are correlated with each other in a quantum mechanical way, and then they are separated by some large distance.
And it doesn't matter how far away they are, theoretically.
Well, it's a practical matter how far you can actually separate them and carry out the experiments. But in one of the cases, the two objects were separated by more than a kilometer. And then the experiment was done, and they had the right correlation in those measurements to support the ideas of quantum mechanics and that there's not an underlying deterministic world.
So the particles are entangled. The question that I have is, can they communicate faster than the speed of light? That seems to be one of the questions right now.
Well, there does seem to be a correlation established between them that seems to violate causality, as we say. But you can't use it to transmit information faster than the speed of light, because you have to wait for the particles to separate from each other, and that will occur according to the usual rules of travel. Nothing can go faster than the speed of light. So you can use these entanglements to carry out what we call a quantum cryptography, where you can transmit little tiny bits of information, but you have to wait for the particles to become separated. So you still can't transmit information faster than the speed of light, but you can transmit it in secret using these correlations. One of the things that has been learned since the days of John Bell, although he started the ball rolling, but lots of other people have worked on it since then, is that if you use a cryptography system that uses quantum entanglement, you can determine if anyone else has listened in on during the transmission of the two particles. Because if anyone else learns about some of the properties of the particles, then the outcomes of the experiments at the two end stations, the two places where you make the final measurements, those will be changed if someone has listened in. And this is very, very important for secure information transmission.
So this is
all this craziness about quantum entanglement actually has a very, very practical application.
Well, that was what I was going to interject with. So this is a real-life potential utility.
Well,
once
people
we understand
have already
the process.
Built information transmission systems that use quantum entanglement, and they continue to work on that. So there's a lot of very smart people who are continuing to improve those systems. But those are real. They're already out there, and you can buy them.
What about teleportation? That's something that, you know, is from Star Trek that looks like quantum entanglement can do.
Well, in principle, you could do that, but, you know, none of this comes at a low cost. So all this, you know, construction that you do to entangle the particles and then transmit them and then do the experiment, there's a lot of energy that gets used to transmit some tiny piece of information. In principle, you can take a system apart and have it reassembled somewhere else. There's a lot of energy that gets used to do that. So you probably could you can teleport very, very small systems. Teleporting a person, like in Star Trek, that would require, like, you know, all the energy of a star to pull that together. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Just the teleportation, as you put it, of ideas, because I spend many hours in front of a class, and, you know, they're not very far away, and I find it very difficult sometimes. So
yes.
The bottom line to this, Steve, is that, in fact, our intuitive understanding of the universe – is just no longer understandable?
Well, there's just this one core idea that the objects that we interact with have a sort of independent existence that doesn't depend on their interaction with us. For large, heavy, slow-moving objects, that's true. But in the world of the atom, it's the interactions between the particles that are paramount. They're part of the game. That helps to define what the particles do.
Well, one final sort of thought. The whole concept of consciousness, right? We don't think about it. How does the brain manipulate information? How does something go from one part of the brain to another? Do they have to be connected traditionally, or can you imagine that there's something to do with quantum mechanics is going on there? And it's all very fascinating for me, and I'm totally ignorant.
Are you giving me another 15 minutes?
No.
But I have...
Steve Pate, thank you so much for being here on Science Studio to help us. And I think you did a lovely job on the sort of the historical understanding. And so quantum weirdness is no longer quite as weird. And I thank you very much for that.
Well,
yes,
thank
and
you
thanks
for giving me the opportunity to be on your program.
And thanks to our producer, Norma Martinez.
And thank you for out there listening. We'll be back next week with a couple more highlights of 2015, and then it's back to normality. So you be there. Bye-bye.